Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. In 1929, Martin Quigley, the editor of the trade paper Motion Picture Herald, and Father Daniel A. Lord, a Jesuit priest, created a code of standards and submitted it to the movie studios. Father Lord was particularly concerned with the seductive power of the new talkies on children. He wrote, "Silent smut had been bad. Vocal smut cried to the censors for vengeance." Several top studio heads met with Lord and Quigley in February 1930 and agreed to most of their demands, and the code went into effect at the end of March of that year. In response, a new breed of independent filmmaker emerged, breaking all of the code's rules on sex, drugs, and childbirth by cloaking them in a banner of moral uplift. Forbidden Fruit, new restorations of 9 of those films, presented by Kino Lorber in association with Something Weird in the Library of Congress, currently being screened on weekends at Film Forum on West Houston Street. And it brings Mr. Wood, Brett Wood, the Vice President and producer of archival releases for Kino Lorber, to our show now. Welcome.
Thanks. I'm excited to be here.
On June 13, 1934, an amendment to the code was adopted, which established the Production Code Administration and required all films released on or after July 1, 1934, to obtain a certificate of approval before being released. How were the rules, had the rules been enforced in a kind of looser until then?
Right, because between the establishment of the code and then when they required their certificates in 34, is what we call the pre-code era, when filmmakers, if they were clever about it, could, using innuendo and visual metaphors, sort of break some of these rules of things, the do's and don'ts, or the don'ts and, you know, do not even suggest kind of things.
Only one of the films in this series, Narcotic, was made before then. It was made in 1933. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it was the first film of the series and was shown last Friday. The series is a 3-week series.
Right.
It began last Friday. What do we miss with Narcotic?
Well, Narcotic is made by a gentleman named Dwayne Esper, who is a self-taught filmmaker. So right away, you're going to get a very different style of film than what was coming out of the studios. But ostensibly a film about opium addiction, it includes everything from marijuana, cocaine, heroin. It shows you a cesarean birth sequence, because a lot of these filmmakers would just throw everything into the film as part of this educational message.
And they presented them as educational messages. Is that how they got around the code?
Right, because there were two big things. First is making it seem educational, and they would usually do this by putting a title scroll at the beginning or having some sort of authority lecture you at the end, and that kind of allowed you to, you know, show the vices and sins during the movie. But the other big thing was these films were self-produced. They're not even like B pictures. These are independent productions.
So none of them were from Hollywood?
Right. Well, they were made in Hollywood, but they were not part of the studio system. And the production code was sort of like our MPAA now. It's self-regulatory. It's voluntary. And the studios abide by that to sort of keep outside censorship. And so by these filmmakers not being part of that pact between the production code authority and the studios, they could bend these rules, and it was just a matter of what theaters could they get these films shown in.
Today, films are rated G, PG, R, and then X, I guess.
Or NC-17.
Yeah. NC-17.
PG-13.
Yeah. That's the way, that's what replaced the code.
Right.
Now, these films are also called exploitation films, and yet, as we said, they all seem to be promoting something worthwhile, at least in theory. Your series subtitle is The Golden Age of the Exploitation Film. Was Narcotic the first one?
No, they've been... They sort of evolved. So even in the silent era, they were making films like this. It goes back to VD films that were made in the silent era and films about white slavery, what we now call, you know, sex trafficking. But the prime was during that period after the production code when other studios could not even, you know, suggest this kind of subject matter. They just dove in headfirst.
In 1999, you co-wrote with Felicia Feaster a book called Forbidden Fruit, The Golden Age of Exploitation Film. In 1998, another one, Marijuana, Motherhood, and Madness, three screenplays from the exploitation cinema of Duane Esper. So he's a key figure in this alternative cinema?
Yes, he was sort of a ruthless businessman. He would... the most extreme kind of films, and again, being unschooled in proper filmmaking, his films have a sort of a reckless style that is totally unique. And to me, those are the films that I enjoy watching the most because they break all the rules of how you're supposed to tell a story and make a film, and they're refreshing.
Although they're also using amateur actors, so sometimes the acting isn't up to Hollywood standards.
It is and it isn't, because a lot of times these are bit players and people who never really got a shot at a major role. And for instance, Narcotic, the main star is a man named Harry Cording, who appears in a lot of Universal horror films in the 30s and 40s, but almost never got any dialogue. And in Narcotic, he carries the film and has this amazing scene at the end where he has he's in withdrawal from opium addiction, and the performance, you don't expect it because it's such a schlocky movie on some levels, but you see him generate tears on screen and he is just unraveling. And every now and then these films would surprise you with something.
Were any of these films submitted to the Production Code Administration?
Usually the filmmakers knew better, but occasionally they thought, well, maybe this film will be different. This will be the breakthrough film. And one film which I love, which is 1932, I should preface it by saying the film doesn't exist anymore. It's called The Seventh Commandment. However, a trailer of the film does survive.
But the code wasn't in effect in 1932.
Well, the production code office was there, but they weren't requiring the certificate, but they would still review films and review scripts through Hollywood. But so he submitted The Seventh Commandment, which I think this will help the listeners sort of understand these films we're talking about. So in addition to addressing the topic of adultery, which is the seventh commandment, it also discussed prostitution, abortion, syphilis, lesbianism. It included cross-dressing, had footage of a cesarean birth, and according to one source, even had surgical footage of a facelift operation. Mm. So, you know, it's like the kitchen sink.
Now, I'm assuming it was opposed to pretty much all of those things.
Well, you know, this is the other thing. I do feel like the filmmakers on a certain level believed the message they were espousing, but at the same time, they were having fun with it. These were not serious attempts to educate and scare viewers, because we know these films mostly through Reefer Madness. That's the most commonly recognized film.
Which is not in the series because it's already too well known.
It's out there and we have a print of it, but I'm looking for one a little bit better. If we're going to do it, let's do it right. And in the 70s, that film was widely shown at midnight screenings and, you know, it was a camp classic and you would go and laugh at it. And the thing is, the people who saw the movie in that context kind of missed the joke. They felt like, this is a serious film. The government made this film. These naive filmmakers, they don't know anything about marijuana. Well, the joke is on the viewer because these filmmakers knew what they were doing. And to me, that's the better way to see the films, is to be in on the joke and realize the filmmaker knew exactly what they're doing. They were winking, sharing this sort of secret relationship with the viewer while they, you know, pulled the wool over the eyes of the censors.
And slipped in as many different shocking things as they could.
Everything they could. And we were talking about the seventh commandment. I jotted this down because it's priceless when they submitted it to the production code. Joseph Breen himself, the head of the production code, wrote this response. He called it, quote, "the most thoroughly vile and disgusting motion picture which the three members of this staff have ever seen. It is thoroughly reprehensible in all its details," end quote.
Now, Joseph Breen was the man who pretty much ran the MPPDA
is what it was at the time.
But it's called the Hayes office.
Right. Well, you know, Hayes was the person who was brought in initially in the 1910s.
Will H. Hayes.
Right.
President of the Motion Picture Producers and Distributors of America.
And then they had different figureheads through the years, and Breen was the figurehead in the early 30s.
And actually, he wound up with it until 1954. So,
and that's pretty much the length of it, because the 50s is when this kind of censorship started to loosen up a little bit. And that kind of killed the exploitation film, because once you no longer had to cloak it in the mantle of education, once you could have nudist films and, you know, Peeping Tom films, then they no longer needed to pretend. And to me, that took the fun out of it. The fun is the how much are they serious about this film, and knowing that the filmmaker's sort of playing a joke or having a, you know, this relationship with the viewer that's not exactly honest, let's say.
So you mentioned Duane Esper. He's one of the people who specialized in making these kinds of films. Another one was Kroger Babb.
Right. Kroger Babb was, he made what we call the Gone with the Wind of exploitation films, because it was the biggest budgeted film at $60,000, again, minuscule by Hollywood standards. And that film was called Mom and Dad, which is an innocuous sort of drama about, it's called, you know, it's what we call a sex hygiene picture. So it's about unwanted pregnancy and venereal disease. And it's a wholesome movie with some musical numbers. But then in the middle of the film, the film stops, and a live lecturer would come up to the front of the theater, always named Elliot Forbes. And
no matter who the person really was.
No matter who the person was actually delivering the lecture. And it's funny, each film of this type had its own lecturer. There was one named Alexander Leeds. There was one named Curtis Hayes. But for Mom and Dad, it was always Elliot Forbes, who would give like a 20-minute lecture about sex education and then sell pamphlets, these booklets, you know, for the men in the audience and the women in the audience, and make a little extra money that way. So it was, there was sort of a carnivalesque feeling around a lot of these films.
And where were they shown? Not in the local movie house.
Yeah, they would be shown, and this is an important thing, is they would be shown in the local movie house, because where they couldn't be shown were the studio-owned picture palaces.
The RKO theaters, the Lowe's theaters.
Right, because those theaters were owned by studios and had to abide by, you know, the judgment of the production code authority. So this allowed mom-and-pop theaters, Main Street theaters, we call them, to have a hot film that people would literally line up around the block to see. I mean, we have photos that show, you know, people just like swarming the box office to get into these films. They were notorious in their day.
Because people wanted to be titillated? Because they liked the idea of the rules being broken?
Yeah, and this is something you couldn't see in the, you know, studio-owned theaters. It was, you know, they would show births of babies in close-up detail. They would show syphilis footage. As horrible as it was to some members of the audience kind of a thrill to see something that is so taboo.
And even some nude scenes.
Yes. And it's funny, when you find the prints of these films, a lot of times no two prints are the same, because some would have more nudity in the film and some prints would have it cut out. So, it was amazing what they were able to get away with.
Well, when you say you found prints in the film, this series is drawing upon stuff from Kino Lorber. That's your company, which is a regular film distribution company.
Yes.
Also, the a thing called
Weird.
Something Weird, which I'd never heard of before. And then the Library of Congress. The Library of Congress has a stash of exploitation films.
Well, the thing I love about the Library of Congress is they preserve cinema in all of its forms and don't pass a judgment on what is appropriate or not appropriate for preservation. the way the series started is Lisa Petrucci of Something Weird, which is a video label which released a lot of these films back in the 90s, came to me and asked if we would be interested in reviving them, bringing them up to date for the Blu-ray era. Mm-hmm. And so that provided us with about a dozen films. And then...
Wait, did Kino Lorber own these films?
Well, we do now, because she was... Her late husband, Mike Vraney, who started the company, Something Weird, had collected 35mm prints. So we own them now, and we supplemented this collection with films from the Library of Congress, UCLA Film Archive, and the Academy Film Archive.
And then went and...
have them scanned, do the digital restoration.
So the quality's a lot better.
Yeah. I mean, the films themselves are, you know, what we call orphan films. You can't find the negatives of these films. No one took care of them because they just passed from hand to hand. The companies that owned them went out of business. So when you find a print like this, it's often the only print that exists and has often been played for 20 years, you know, 30 years ago.
Even some of the studio films have been kind of lost. I just heard about a film, a sound film, where the sound was on disc, mm-hmm. and the disc has been lost. And so we have what looks like a really interesting film by a famous director, but nobody knows what they're saying.
And it's frustrating, and sometimes the reverse will happen. They will find the disc, and then they won't have the film to go with it.
I'm speaking with Brett Wood about a series that is currently being screened on weekends at Film Forum on West Housen Street. You've said, this is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. You've said that, and I'm quoting, as a film historian, you're most interested in facilitating the rediscovery of films that have played an important role in the evolution of cinema but have been overlooked by traditional histories of the art form. So, two questions there. Mm-hmm. Are these really important films, and had most of them disappeared?
They're very important films because they show us how filmmakers got around censorship, how they pushed back against censorship. And also it tells us a lot about independent filmmaking, that when the industry gets so controlled by corporations, they can dominate the industry and sometimes put a stranglehold on the independents. But in this case, the independents had a loophole, and that was not being bound by the production code, which not only allowed the filmmakers to flourish, but, as I was saying, allowed these independently owned movie theaters to survive during the Great Depression. So it's a story that doesn't get told often because the films themselves are considered disreputable or quote-unquote trash.
But and most of them were made during the Great Depression.
Right.
Not all of them.
No, because they continue into the 50s, but to me the prime era is like maybe 33 to 49. That's when censorship was the tightest, and that's when the best of these films were being made.
You said that some of them had almost disappeared. One of them is one of the Duane Esper films. It's a 14-minute film called How to Take a Bath from 1937, one of the oddest films I have ever seen in my life. It begins with two couples playing a game of bridge, and one of the couples is bickering. And I thought, where is this going to go?
Well, I didn't believe the film actually existed because, A, how could anyone get away with making a film called How to Make a Bath? It turns out the film does exist. So we are the first people to put it out on video.
Where did you find it?
Something Weird had it. Lisa Petrucci had a print. And I think the reason it has been so seldom seen is that it's not educational. It can't pretend to be educational because the couples, after playing bridge, they each go to their apartments and the two women
take
baths and the film watches them. You know,
we see them briefly in the nude, not full frontal, but still there are nude scenes here.
Yeah. And the thing about these films is that when there is nudity, usually it's not completely out and unobstructed. So it almost turns the viewer into a voyeur because you have to, you know, you catch glimpses of things. And in the case of a film I'm sure we'll talk about later called Child Bride, it will obscure the nudity with like plants and water and things like that. But And so that makes the viewer like, you know, unconsciously or involuntarily try to look harder to see you know, the forbidden.
And in one of the films, there's even a lot of talk about peeping Toms.
Yes.
And a guy looks through peepholes.
Yeah, that's the companion film to How to Take a Bath, and that's called How to Undress, also known as How to Undress in Front of Your Husband, which is a sort of a tongue-in-cheek instructional film for the proper methods of disrobing.
But interestingly, it stars a woman who's fairly prominent. She was John Barrymore's last wife.
Yeah, occasionally these filmmakers could get someone, usually when they were in the decline of their careers. One of Charlie Chaplin's ex-wives, Lita Gray Chaplin, is in a film. A lot of silent movie stars, a lot of silent movie directors past their prime were making these films. But my favorite casting coup of all time is for the anti-drug film She Shoulda Said No. Stars a woman named Lila Leeds. And so this film was made in 49. In 1948, Lila Leeds was arrested in a very high-profile drug bust with Robert Mitchum. Mm. His career went on. He continued to make films. Hers was over.
Did that make her a draw for this audiences for this film?
For this film.
Because she was in the headlines?
And she was in the headlines on the subject of marijuana. So here she's in a film reenacting her smoking marijuana. And this is another one produced by the big producer I was talking about, Kroger Babb, one of his big hits, and also known as Wild Weed. They would frequently change the titles of the film so that they could re-release them over and over and over.
How to Take a Bath is interesting in a number of other ways. Well, first of all, it's a short, and mm-hmm. These films range from full length to... Well, this one is 10 minutes long, or even mm-hmm. a little less. This one's 14. It followed some of the rules of the code because both of the couples wind up going to bed, but in twin beds, which was one of the rules of the code.
Right. It's funny that the things that they would choose to honor in the production code, and maybe it's just that in some ways they're so rooted in the conventions of, you know, how you show a film that you follow some rules while you consciously break others.
The twin bed thing was interesting because there were all sorts of other rules. For example, one of the spouses could sit on the edge of the bed, but that was about the closest it could come. It had to be fully clothed and sitting on the edge of the bed.
One foot on the floor. That's always
one
how
foot
I
on
heard
the
it.
Floor.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, audiences knew what really was going on.
And that makes it sort of silly that Hollywood for so long would pretend, you know, why even try to disguise things like this? Like, for instance, you couldn't use the word pregnant in Hollywood films. You couldn't show a woman
until Otto Preminger insisted on using it.
Yeah, and that's
he
well
used
into
the word
the,
abortion, didn't he?
I think so, in Anatomy of a Murder. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But like, you couldn't show a woman's bulging stomach. These were things that, I mean, but come on, it's... You would have movies about someone having a child, but you could not do certain things.
Well, I remember June Allison telling Jimmy Stewart, not saying I'm pregnant. She said, we're going to have a baby or some other thing, a way of getting around it.
Yeah, in exploitation films, the phrase is in trouble. I'm in trouble. Susie's in trouble.
So even when the pregnancy was perfectly fine, it was a trouble?
Well, pregnancies are never perfectly fine in exploitation films. There's always, that's got to be a source of sort of prurient interest because it usually means unwed motherhood or venereal disease. Because in exploitation films, you kind of get this tainted, you know, view of youth, high school kids going to roadhouses and drinking. There's never a normal, happy story.
So these films cover a wide range of things. The dangers of premarital sex, the evils of syphilis, not punishing criminals harshly enough, the dangers of drug use. In a way, they were all doing the things that the code would have wanted.
Right. They almost took the list. There was this famous list called Don'ts and Be Carefuls. And there are things like you can't show someone killing a police officer. You can't show drug addiction. And the exploitation filmmakers basically took this list and like, let's make a script and use as many of these elements as possible.
One of the films was made by a company called Hygienic Productions.
Right, that's Kroger Babb.
It's like an inside joke.
But that was, and it was the only production that Hygienic made, because once Mom and Dad was such a huge success, and it really was a huge success, he changed the name to Hallmark Production so that they could branch out. And his next film was called The Lawton Story. He had a good thing going, and then he went a new direction. And it's about a town in Oklahoma that does a big passion play every year. So it was a religious-themed film, and they sold souvenir booklets about the Passion of the Christ and this town's efforts to stage this massive passion play. And it was a huge bomb, and that sent him back to drug addiction with He Should Have Said No, and alcoholism with One Too Many.
Well, even religious films. Cecil B. DeMille did a religious film that had problems with the code. What were the problems there? It was just because he...
Well, I mean, someone like Kroger Babb and Dwayne Esper basically take a page out of the Cecil B. DeMille playbook, which is, if you are going to show a film about the fall of Babylon, for example, for about 20 minutes, you get to show Babylon at its worst. You get to see people worshiping the golden calf. You get to see what it was that God was trying to punish humanity for. And the audience got to see this sort of taboo display of sex and debauchery, but then kind of be brought back to a if not a morally superior stance, but at least a more comfortable position once judgment is made on the sinners and good prevails.
You mentioned the film Child Bride, which is about child marriage. About the evils of child marriage among impoverished mountain folk, and covers a wide range of topics. And the heroine is a teacher who is kind of modern, and she's trying to get these backward folk to stop doing these awful things. But as you mentioned, it features a fairly long nude scene. Shockingly, a 12-year-old actress, who, by the way, is a pretty good actress, I thought, named Shirley Mills. Now, could Shirley Mills have a career after that?
Well, she actually did. A couple of years later, she is one of the Joad children in John Ford's The Grapes of Wrath. But I don't think she had a career beyond being a child actor. And I don't think this film was probably widely seen enough to have impacted her Hollywood career.
Now, would couples go to see these movies?
They may have, but they wouldn't have sat together, because this is one of the fascinating things about at least the what we call sex hygiene films. It was traditional to segregate the audience. And the women would see the film during the matinee screenings, and then men would see the films in the evenings. And from what we've heard from people who were there at the time, the tone was very different. The daytime screenings, people actually listened, actually got information from the sex lecturer about things like birth control and the rhythm method, because, you know, the dissemination of birth control information was illegal up until 38. So these films were playing in the 30s, and they were a source of some legitimate information. The nighttime shows, when the men were there to see it, it was more of a thrill ride that people had heard about Mom and Dad. Of course, this is in the 40s by the time we get to Mom and Dad, but it was almost like a circus to see this film and the shocking footage that is contained in the final reel.
I'm speaking with Kino Lorber's Brett Wood, who has put together a series called Forbidden Fruit, restorations of 9 of the so-called exploitation films made between 1933 and 1948. Is the last
right,
one?
I think that's right, yeah.
And they are being screened on weekends at Film Forum on West Houston Street. This is Leonard Lopate at Large. The films we're discussing today broke the rules by defying the Motion Picture Production Code with Brett Wood of Kino Lorber. You have a long title at Kino Lorber. You wear a number of hats?
That's right. I've done a little bit of everything at Kino Lorber.
And you've also been a filmmaker.
Yes, that's right. And I've sort of embraced the name dilettante, because to me, the most fun I can have is by trying my hand at a little bit of everything, exploring. So I've, you know, made films, I've written about films, I've produced a scripted podcast, but my...
Are you still doing the podcast?
Yes, it's...
You just started one this month, didn't you?
It comes at, it's been pushed back a little bit, but it's going to come out this spring, called The Seventh Daughter.
Mm-hmm. And what is that named after?
It's an old superstition that the seventh daughter of a psychic would have especially keen psychic powers. And it's about a young girl who's being trained to be a phony psychic back in the 1920s.
Seventh daughter, that's a lot of kids. Oh, Eddie Cantor, no, did he have daughters or sons? I can't remember. Mm-hmm. Getting back to the code.
Sure.
It was divided into two parts, and the first was a set of general principles which prohibited a picture from lowering the moral standards of those who see it so as not to wrongly influence a specific audience of views that included women, children, people of lower classes. Mm. Wow, there's that's interesting. And people with susceptible minds. It called for depictions of the correct standards of life and forbade any sort of ridicule towards a law or creating sympathy for its violation.
Which, you know, everyone is, you know, agreeable to these kinds of rules. But at the same time, we need to have some sort of sensational, you know, there needs, if in movies we love to see crime, we love to see vice, we love to see it vanquished in the end. Sometimes, not
well,
always.
Well, by the code, you had to. The right. Criminal had to be vanquished in the end. It was only after the end of the code that criminals could get away with what they did.
But it was, you know, it. We need to be able to explore. We need to show the underbelly of life in America, whether it's for entertainment or whether it is to make a political point or a social commentary or whether it is to actually teach a legitimate lesson about things like this.
But I was curious about the people they thought had to be protected: women, children, people of lower class, and people with susceptible minds.
Yeah, there's
not
always
men.
That moral superiority of these things. And for instance, in addition to the production code, there are various state and local censor boards. And when you read their verdicts on films, you know, you would often find like this might tend to incite to crime, or this might tend to corrupt morals. It was always, it won't corrupt our morals, but it might corrupt the morals of someone who's not as strong and willful.
And even some films that passed the production code were banned in certain states.
Right.
There were, and some states, some of the states, the codes were administered by religious groups.
Right. And you know, so, and that's why you would often have, at least with exploitation films, different versions of the films, depending on where you were seeing it. And they had a trick where they would, for instance, in the New York Censor Board, submit a film, and it would be passed with changes. So they would cut out the scenes that were required to be cut out. But then when it came time to actually screen the film, they would send an uncensored print. And if they ever got caught, they could just say, oops, we didn't know how that happened, but we'll make sure that a proper print gets sent back out next time.
The second part was a list of items that could not be depicted, and that included homosexuality because they forbade sex perversion. That's what they said.
Yeah.
Miscegenation, marriage, sexual relations between different races.
Yeah.
It stated that an adults-only policy would be a dubious, ineffective strategy because it would really be difficult to enforce.
Right.
But we're doing that now with R films and X-rated films, and what is the other one?
NC-17.
NC-17s.
But, like, does the rating system mean anything anymore? I wonder when the last time is that someone was turned away from a theater because they didn't have ID. It seems like with the internet, which has no real age restriction upon it, that a lot of these barriers have fallen, and I'm curious to see how it affects. It's already, you know, it affects TV. They're showing things on television now that could not have gotten away with 10 years ago.
Sexual relations outside of marriage was forbidden. So how did they deal with films like Casablanca, which suggested that Rick and, now I've forgotten her name,
Ilsa
had gone to bed with each other in Paris.
I think just the audience would know there was enough sort of nonverbal communication of these things that if someone had a relationship and they shared a cigarette and kissed in Paris, we know what happened. But, you know, technically in the script, they're not saying anything happened. And, you know, in the pre-code era, filmmakers could push it further and suggest more. But if it's always that ability of a filmmaker to make the viewer understand something without coming out and telling them that. And to me, that's what makes cinema. That's when cinema is the most effective, is when the audience figures it out or is involved enough in the story that they have a deeper understanding of what's going on in the film.
The first major instance of censorship under the production code involved 1934 classic Tarzan and His Mate, which had nude scenes. Supposedly Maureen O'Sullivan, although it was really a body double. So it was taken out of the master negative of the film. Do we still have both versions?
Yes. I would say about 10 years ago, created a restored version with the swimming scene reinstated. So fortunately, a lot of times the footage does survive. King Kong's another great example. It was cut under the production code. Other films, you know, those scenes have been lost.
Betty Boop had to change from being a flapper, began to wear an old-fashioned housewife's skirt. What was the response of the writers, the directors, and the Hollywood moguls to when Breen decided to change scripts?
I mean, it took the fun out of it, I think, but at the same time, it was their jobs, and the Hollywood industry became more of a factory-type operation. It was already becoming that way under Irving Thalberg. He's the person who organized this system of production where you have a screenplay department, a art department, a editing department.
That was MGM?
Yes. And everything sort of was made by committee instead of one filmmaker overseeing the production from start to finish. It would just, like an assembly line, go into different departments. And so you get what is a film that has a slick, polished look and that feels like an MGM film and feels less like a film by, say, Todd Browning or King Vidor.
One of the studios that pushed hardest against the code was Warner Brothers. And the production code administration also engaged in political censorship when Warner Brothers wanted to make a film about concentration camps in Nazi Germany. The production office forbade it because it cited prohibitions on depicting in an unfavorable light another country's institutions and prominent people. That still strikes me as kind of shocking. It only changed, and a number of anti-Nazi movies never got produced because of that.
Yeah.
And especially since all these emigres were coming from Germany and wanted to make movies, Fritz Lang and people like that.
Yeah, in the 30s, late 30s, you couldn't say anything bad about Mussolini. Sometimes I would see correspondence which would say this movie has a disparaging comment about Mussolini or Hitler, and that would have to be taken out because we have, and I think it was more because we have film distribution connections in Europe and we don't want to limit ourselves to, say, the UK only.
So Germany was a good market.
Yes. And, you know, up until the formal declaration of war, we didn't make anti-fascist
films. Actually, it started in 1938 when the FBI unearthed and prosecuted a Nazi spy ring. So then Warner's was allowed to do Confessions of a Nazi Spy. And even more interesting, I thought, Three Stooges made a short subject in January 1940 called The Nazi Spy. a spoof on Hitler and his people.
Yeah.
Then another thing happened. 43, we have a famous case of The Outlaw with starring mm-hmm. Jane Russell.
Right. Which we did a release of that film as well. Because that was a film where Howard Hughes was the producer and he was very much into pushing back against the production code authority. And in fact, some of his films from the 30s are just now being restored to their uncensored form. There's a film with the amazing title of Cock of the Air, which I saw a screening of 2 years ago, which has nothing overtly inappropriate in it, but it is so filled with sexual innuendo. It's about a womanizing pilot that the film
even the just title
got chopped up, even the title. So yeah, he was always pushing back against the production code, and then The Outlaw, with its, you know, which so much attention is focused upon, you know, the bosom of Jane Mansfield, just sent the production code into spasms of hysteria.
Well, they wanted to censor the advertising for the film.
Yeah, and that was a thing where part of even the New York Censor Board, part of its mission was to control advertising, the trailers, the posters. So there were, you know, almost every level of the industry was being scrutinized for inappropriate content.
On the other hand, some of Hollywood's creative people seem to think there was a positive side to the code's limitations. Edward Dimitri, a pretty famous director, said the code had a very good effect because it made us think. If we wanted to get something across that was censorable, and we had to do it deviously, we had to be clever, and it usually turned out to be a much better than if we had just done it straight.
I mean, he's probably talking about what we call the pre-code era, where there were these rules, but they were not being strictly enforced. And that's when you have the great Warner Brothers pictures, the gangster pictures, the sort of racy sex comedies.
Barbara Stanwyck becomes a superstar,
right,
for good
exactly.
reason.
Things like Baby Doll and Redheaded Woman, films that really, I credit Bruce Goldstein and the Film Forum for putting on our cultural radar of showing that in the early 30s, you had this playful, lively, irreverent style of filmmaking. But then in 34, like you said, that's when the code said no more suggestion, no more innuendo, everything needs to be whitewashed. And that's when that playful relationship that a filmmaker had with the audience, just like with the exploitation films, ended for the Hollywood filmmakers. And the exploitation filmmakers were lucky in that they could continue to do that and pretend to be an educational filmmaker, but actually, you know, break out the laundry list of things you're not allowed to depict and then fill your film with it.
Getting back to the series, the three-part series, we missed the first one. On Friday, you showed Narcotic, Duane Esper's 1933 film. Saturday, Mom and Dad by William Bodine, who... Didn't he make some regular Hollywood films?
Yeah, he was a big director in the silent era. He made a Mary Pickford film, Sparrows. A lot of the higher echelon exploitation films were made by veteran Hollywood directors like Earl Kenton and Louis Gosnier, who made Reefer Madness.
And then on Sunday you showed Child Bride and How to Take a Bath. Now, what determined what films you put together? Was it just simply a matter of them adding up to 90 minutes or 2 hours?
No, I mean, we tried to, like, as I framed last night's screening of Child Bride and How to Take a Bath, both are sort of about voyeurism. The first night where we showed Narcotic and The Seventh Commandment, I wanted to show some of Duane Esper's early works. And later on, when we have She Should Have Said No, which is the marijuana film, which plays more like a film noir, I have it paired with a thing called The March of Crime. Duane Esper made these true crime documentaries, short films. And so there are two of those, and one of those will be playing with She Should Have Said No. So it has like kind of a gritty crime feeling to it.
Some of these films just seem to be all over the place. So one of the films has people going to the burlesque show,
right,
and then has burlesque dancers, but it doesn't take advantage of it. It just, I guess, the implication that there's something sexy because burlesque is mentioned.
Well, it's almost
they don't show the little bit of the burlesque show,
right,
that they show is rather tame.
It's pretty wholesome. You see the women in the dressing room, and there's some chatter there. But what's interesting is that it's almost as if watching the burlesque show is the thing that triggers people's criminal behavior. It's in the audience that one woman says to her friend, why don't you spend the night at my place tonight? So it's a sort of suggestion of lesbianism, which doesn't get followed up on later in the film. And a man outside the theater, this creepy looking guy, starts to stalk a child after having just gone to the burlesque theater. So there's not often a lot of logic, and they don't stick to the script.
And then the main part of the film is about one of the dancers who seems to be a sweet young thing, mm-hmm. who made the terrible mistake of having had sex out of wedlock, mm-hmm. becoming pregnant, and also didn't she also develop
contract syphilis?
Syphilis,
yeah.
And she has a sweetheart waiting for her at home. She really wants to marry him, but she knows she can't because she has syphilis.
And then, of course, the thing that
it's really a complicated plot.
And often people go to the quack. That was the big thing. Don't go to a quack. That's even part of the medical lecture that accompanies mom and dad. So she goes to someone who pretends to cure her. Then she gets married, has the child, but passes along the syphilis to the child, and which is a really tragic story. And in a lot of these films, the tragedy comes across. So they're films that are a little unpredictable. We think you can laugh at them, but at the same time, they have a way of surprising you with moments of emotion. And I should mention that this is sort of apocryphal. I don't know how true it is. I'd like to verify it. But the film Child Bride, which we were talking about, which is a pretty creepy film, I got to admit, is one of the only films that the group Mystery Science Theater viewed and decided not to make fun of because it just didn't feel right to laugh at it. So to me, that's a score. That's a good point because I don't think the film should be laughed at.
No,
I think there's plenty of...
In fact, there's a lot of sympathy toward the impoverished people of this this mountain area. But it's to some degree, it's also a film about city folks commenting mm-hmm. on what people in the real rural parts of America, what their lives are like, the reason that they would even have child brides.
Yeah, there's serious content, and it's nice to think about that, even as there are moments that, like one of the most disgusting moments is the grown man leans over to kiss his fiancée, 12-year-old fiancée, and she has to wipe the tobacco juice mm-hmm. from her chin because he had a mouthful of tobacco when he kissed her. You know, it's those kind of moments that makes the film fun to watch, but at the same time, there are disturbing aspects and sort of dramatically satisfying moments. So these are real mishmashes.
But the titles really do give you a clue. Narcotic Mom and Dad, Child Bride, Marijuana Weed with Roots in Hell, The March of Crime, Test Tube Babies. That's the one of the last films.
Well, and this shows that any topic was suitable. And so Test Tube Babies, if there's a headline about it, there's an exploitation film waiting to be made. Mm-hmm. Just like Ed Wood's film Glenn or Glinda was about the famous sex change operation that was in the news at the time. They made films about nudism, but that, I guess, is a topic that it's easy to make an exploitation film about. But also things like sterilization. There's an exploitation film about polygamy. So just about any topic that is not discussed in polite circles has an exploitation film about it.
One of the titles is great. She Should Have Said No. And then Sex Madness, that's kind of like a play on Reefer Madness?
Right. I think Sex Madness is a title that was given to the film later, and it was originally shown as Human Wreckage, but it also had the title They Must Be Told, because the thing is, they would change these titles regularly. She Should Have Said No was also released as Wild Weed. So you might go to a theater in 1944 and see a film for the third time under a different title with a different ad campaign.
What about your films? Because we're pretty much out of time, but I'm curious about them. A driver's ed documentary called Hell's Highway, the true story of highway safety films. And then you did The Unwanted, Psychopathia Sexualis. And you have a film coming out this year called Those Who Deserve to Die.
That's right. I've always been sort of interested in the, I don't know, people who live in the shadows. And as far as the closest to this kind of project with Forbidden Fruit would be the driver's ed documentaries, because those are films that traumatized a whole generation of school children, became sort of a cult classic. But I wanted to interview the people who made these Death on the Highway documentaries and tell the story behind it. And it's pretty fascinating stuff, if I do say so myself.
So next Friday, we have the second part of the series, and then the following week, the third.
That's
right. Then that's it.
No, we skip a week, and then on the 30th, we come back for She Should Have Said No, which is a great one to close on, because that's the Lila Leeds marijuana scare film.
We've been talking about Forbidden Fruit, nine films being presented on weekends at Film Forum. My great thanks to Brett Wood, Vice President and Producer of Archival Releases at Kino Lorber. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Thanks for letting us talk about it for at such length. I appreciate it, Leonard.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Brett Wood, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my executive producer, Jesse Lynn. Leonard Lopate and Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.